Hi, this is Katie Day, and welcome to Creating Ripples, the program that showcases inspirational women across the globe. Sometimes it is the small acts and achievements that can create the biggest ripples. We're here to share some amazing stories. They will make you laugh. Sometimes they may make you cry. They will always inspire you. Today, it is my absolute pleasure to be interviewing Hasina Zaman. Hasina is the CEO of Compassionate Funerals, founded in September 2012. Hasina's focus is to lead funerals that are infused with compassionate care, making sure that bereaved families and friends are sensitively cared for, and their loved ones' contribution and characteristics are truly reflected throughout the funeral experience. Hasina quickly realised that the public feared and stayed away from engaging with and embracing death, dying, and bereavement. She decided to work with various end-of-life care organisations to open up the arena of death and dying and host death cafes in partnership with a variety of community groups. Hosting death cafes has allowed Hasina to experience and embrace difficult conversations on death and dying. Death cafes attract people from all walks of life who share their experiences of personal bereavement, planning our departure, feelings about their own death, and different types of death, such as suicide, accidental, baby child, to sudden deaths. They offer an open and safe space that allows attendees to explore unresolved experiences and can be hugely healing. Each death cafe has a natural occurring theme. In May 2015, Hasina's eldest brother died. She led his funeral and hosted a death cafe with her siblings and his music family. The theme that evolved was one of the journey of the soul. Hasina believes the way we live is the way we die. When we decide to live well, we decide to die well, allowing us to leave the world a better place. She accepts those we leave behind will be saddened by our loss. Our heart's job is to love one another. With death, the heart feels sadness. It's our responsibility to care for people who are bereaved and to return them back to their life's purpose. Death cafes are a powerful platform to truly embrace this transition. Hasina, that's such a wonder. It's one of the most moving, heartfelt and wonderful introductions I think I've read out since I started the radio. Thank you so much for being interviewed. I really appreciate your time. One of the things that the sentence that really jumped out when I was reading this, it's our responsibility to care for people who are bereaved and return them back to their life's purpose. That is such a wonderful phrase. Can you tell us more about how you do that?
Well, I have to be honest, I don't think I do that very, very well, because our focus is really, in terms of our work, running Compassionate Funerals, is really to focus on doing the funeral. And sure. Working with the bereaved families, friends, during that part of the process.
Right.
However, and often that journey is quite a short journey.
Right.
So it could be, you know, a day if it's a Muslim family.
Yeah.
Or it could be a maximum of about a month. So we don't actually see the families for a very, very long time. So, however, we've realised that there's a real gap in our service as ourselves as a funeral director. I do not hereby speak on behalf of any other funeral director of the funeral industry at all. You know, I'm too tiny for that. So we started to seeing that, because after we do the funeral, within about between two weeks to a month, we do something called an aftercare visit. And that's really first, and the reason why that came about is because we started doing funerals we did some funerals for, say, a young mum that passed away who had three children. And, you know, I have young children. And I thought, well, if I passed away, who would actually look after, you know, their father and them?
Mm.
And who would, you know, and rather than to leave it up to chance, so we started this, you know, this particular touch point, really. And that was just it was just genuinely to see, are they okay, you know? Mm. Do they need any more signposts? Do they need any more care? How are they just getting on? This is like a huge, it's like a huge event that's just passed through their life and what's happening. So in terms of coming back to, you know, why we really say that is because we, you know, bereavement can actually, you know, in most times it can completely devastate you, take you to your deepest, darkest moment, thinking that you can't live on because this person's gone, especially when this person's been a significant other or it's been, you know, death of a child or one of the sort of tragic sudden deaths. It just really just takes it all out of you. And so it's like, so how do we actually, as a community, so outside funeral directors, as well as funeral, as well as people who work in bereavement counselling, how do we as a community really actually care for that person who's just been bereaved? And when I mean, like, it's our responsibility, I mean, like, you know, having a cup of tea with them, you know, and just by listening to them. I've got friends, like, even just today before you turned up, I've got a client of ours called me up, who's taken a funeral plan with us. But most of that conversation, it lasted for about 25, maybe about 40 minutes, I can't remember. But most of that time, he actually spoke about the loss of his father and what it was like. And so in many ways, although his father died in the early 70s, so we're talking like 40 years later, he still hadn't processed the fact that he had to tell his mom his father had passed away. He himself now is in his late 70s. But, you know, so we carry that in our imprint. We carry that level of loss and that, or what happened at that moment. If we can't just express that and share that, what it was like, we carry it in our cellular level. And then what that happens is that runs a story, because there's an imprint. There's an imprint that gets printed, and then we keep carrying that trauma on and on and on. And then we start to lead our lives with it. Whereas, and if we can say, actually, you know what? I'm here to listen to you. I'm here to say, I'm here to accept whatever you say, whatever you feel, however you feel, it doesn't matter. But I'm here actually just to accept, you know, what you've gone through and completely accept you for that. And that in itself is hugely healing.
It's an incredible gift. It's a priceless gift. We'll get on to talking about the different styles of funerals and the length. You know, some are immediate after death, and some, depending on your spiritual, religious or culture, will be longer. I know for me, when both my parents died, they died within 6 months of each other 5 years ago, that there is so much to do to organise a funeral that you kind of go into this numb state. You go into event management mode because there's so much to do. And after the funeral, when everybody has said their goodbyes, they think, okay, that's it, done. But for the bereaved, that's when the bereavement process starts. Because you're so busy preparing for the funeral, you actually only really get in touch with grief after the funeral. And that's when everybody's gone. Suddenly they've scattered into the woods and you don't see anybody. Mm. So that gift that you give to people is absolutely priceless.
And coming back to your life's purpose, you know, we all have a purpose. Mm. Whatever your belief system is or non-belief system is, as human beings, you know, hugely gifted people, and it's only, you know, then it's about, you know, if that person is then supported and cared for and can resolve. Some people say you never ever get over the loss of somebody. I don't know whether you get over. I would like to say that, you know, you can use them and their love to actually say, look, just help me get on with my life, you know, because I cannot be paralyzed by your loss. You know, you can start having that conversation even with that person. I even sometimes say that. I say, look, when I'm doing a funeral and I'm right in the middle of arranging the funeral and this person is like in really, really deep, numb state and they cannot move, I'll just say, look, if they were sat in your heart, what would they say to you? They'd say, buckle up, get your act together and answer her questions. I mean, I'm getting so many, like, really, and I was going, whoa, where did that come from? And that is about that person's soul still living on, you know? Yeah. They're still there. But because we are so attached to the physicality and the material and everything is in a formed, you know, state, that we can't imagine our life with somebody if they're in a formless state. Actually, I don't even know I'm going like that.
You're right. It does rock your world, doesn't it?
Yeah,
when you lose somebody you're close to. kind of getting over it. It's, I think our life, not think, I know because I've experienced it. For me, our life changes. So it's not a case of, in inverted commas, getting over it. It's just our life shifts on its axis. And it will never be the same as it was before that person died. It's going to be different. And it's I guess, about accepting the difference and how you be within that different space, isn't it? And being able to adjust. And it's like putting on a new cloak. It's going to feel really awkward and heavy. And then eventually that you'll sort of mold yourself into this new being, this new form of living. And that takes time, and it's a process.
Yeah, and it takes time. And if you haven't seen somebody and they know, like, I met one of my friend's aunts, and they knew that I lost my brother, but in a way, they didn't know how to actually say, well, I'm really sorry you lost your brother. I mean, it would have been simple and easy. But instead, she said to me, so how many brothers and sisters are you? And that just, like, killed me, because I thought, I have to say I've only got two brothers. And it was like, I thought, why don't you just, like, stick a knife down my heart? And it's what it felt like. It felt really, really painful. Yeah. But, and then all my friends just, like, you know, they were like a wolf pack, you know, they all went, yeah, you know, her brother passed away. So they basically came and just, they were like my, like, bodyguards, you know? They said, yeah, she's got one sister and two brothers, and you know she's lost a brother. And I said, yeah. And it was just about, so it's like every change is, like, subtle and little. You're not going to know when it's going to hit you.
No.
And, you know, especially if you haven't seen someone who's close to you, and you see them and you say, well, actually, I've just lost. And they went, yeah. And you're just like, oh, like, all into bits, you know. But then that's fine as well.
It is fine. Yeah. But we are rubbish. And I say we as in British. Are rubbish at dealing with death. We are really, really not very good at having those conversations. I remember a girlfriend of mine, she lost her husband when she was in her early 30s. And she said people that she'd known all her life, you know, neighbours in the same street, if she was walking down the street and they were coming towards her, they used to cross over so they could have avoided having that conversation. And I was so shocked. But we just are so full of angst, of not knowing what to say, terrified of saying the wrong thing, that it's easier just to ignore the person and pretend we haven't seen them. I mean, that's so shocking that we just can't reach out in that compassionate space and just say, are you okay? But we do find it incredibly difficult. How do you help people have those conversations?
Well, we run a whole host of public engagement events, from death cafes, workshops on difficult conversations. We run workshops on planning my future. We've just come up with a new service that we have, and it's about really just laying your funeral wishes. And it's a conversation with lots of questions, similar questions to a funeral or a funeral plan, the funeral arranging. We have sheets that we use for clients, and that's probably, I mean, we've just started that, and we've only had one person go through that. And at the end of that conversation, we can actually say we can actually put a ballpoint figure on how much it's going to cost. Ah. And B, what it does, the process actually lays out exactly who you need to speak to for your instructions and your decisions you've made for your funeral wishes. And what that does, it actually empowers that person to take some action,
right,
and to make their wishes known. Because even if they don't want to take out, invest in a prepaid funeral plan, but what they do, they're like filled with so much more information, which then it's up to them. It's up to them to take it forward or not. And if they don't, then, you know, that's their choice.
Sure.
It's never a judgment call, but it's like what we want to do is actually, you know, have those conversations constructively.
Yeah.
Have those conversations so it empowers you, not like it makes you, oh my God, I'm going to die. And, you know, but we say, yeah, of course, you know, but I'm going to die, you know, we're all going
to
die.
We forget that the only guarantee the second we're born is that we are going to die. And we seem to shelve that thought, don't we? I think, well, it's not going to happen to me. I'm going to be the one person who will never die, who will live forever. But we are all going to die. But it's facing that our own mortality can be incredibly scary for a lot of people, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. I have to be honest, when I first started doing the funerals, Katie, I didn't want to die because life is great.
It is.
You know, life is great. Yeah. I'm very grateful. I have a lovely, like more than lovely, wonderful family. I've got a brilliant set of friends. Why would I want to leave this world? I just want to be like one of the superheroes and just live forever. But then I realized, hang on, I'm like providing a service where I'm going to die myself. So I've had to go through my own funeral wishes and my own, planning what that is. But I feel what I've seen is that more people talk about it, there's like less, because what they've dealt with is that unknown fear, that unknown, that terror, that things that make us really, really, like, just really frightened. And it's like, and those things that create those fears in us is basically the unknown, the unexplored. Yeah. And a lot of them are just like mystified rubbish. They've got very little, they could be like, they've experienced something that's different when they're in their childhood or if they believe in past lives, and it's just still in the imprint, of their cells. And that needs resolving, and that needs supporting and clearing and healing. That's very different. But majority of the time, it's like, they just don't. There are some people who just don't want to die, and and part of that is because they can't imagine. Like even in the industry that I'm in, people say, "Look, I just cannot imagine my children without me," and I feel like that. And the worst of it is that I can't imagine my life without one of my kids or one of my children. It's like when people say that to me, I say, I know, it's like awful. But you know what? You're never given something you can't bear. That's the truth.
It is true. Sometimes it's difficult to hang on to.
It is really difficult. Yeah. Especially when I see parents, no matter how old they are. Like my father, he had to bury his son last summer. And there's this sort of statement that the loss of a child is the most painful experience that we go through in anything.
Yeah.
And I said that this to him, I said, look, you wouldn't have received this if you could not handle it. You can handle it, so therefore you have received it. And that he felt like saying, look, why don't you just kill me straight away for saying that? And I said, but, you're just really upset, and I can see how it's like really affecting your diet, your health, your everything. But, he chose this. And even on Monday, I was with a parent who lost her 51-year-old daughter, and I just took her by the hand and I said to her, look, I'm really sorry, and I can see this is really, really tough, and it is really tough losing a child, and I have no experience of it. And I said, look, my father lost his son, my brother, last year. And she said to me, it's really, really hard. And I said, and I didn't say that, look, I did choose my moment, my statements, I didn't say that, like, you wouldn't get this if you were just on the funeral. I thought, I can't. I just said, just be easy on yourself. That's all I said to her. I said, go easy, And she, it was really interesting what she was saying. What she was saying is that she never told me. I said, as children, we don't actually want to say everything to our parents because we don't want we don't want to worry our parents, especially if they've got lots of worries, especially if they've got a worrying program or mindset. They spend their life like in the worry or anxiety zone. So she said, yeah, but she could have told me. I said, but you was with her. At least she was there, and the reason why she probably is because you live so far in Wales and she lives here, you're like 4 hours away, and it was her way. But then she said, we did have our chats, we used to talk every 10 days in great length. So,
and children don't want to worry their parents.
Yeah, I don't. No. I mean, I my father got no idea what I do. He hasn't. And I'd like to just keep it like that. He knows I run a funeral service, but the detail...
Oh, that's good.
I could just, but the detail... And he's very proud, he's actually really, really proud that, we run a funeral service. And, but he doesn't need to know the detail.
No. And parents, by default, are going to worry about their children.
Yeah.
And you never stop being a child. I can remember I was 50 when my parents died. According to them, you could have knocked an auto off. I was still 5, You're always a child to your parents, aren't you? However old you are. And a parent never expects to bury their child.
Never.
It's incredible. So how did you started September 2012. How did it come about, Compassionate Funerals? Was it something completely different to what you'd done before?
Completely different. I've got a teaching, education, training background.
Okay.
And I've sort of dabbled in a little bit of art when it wasn't working. So really, my core background is in teaching and training and in post-16 education. I did sports science at university.
Oh, my gosh.
I'd like
so completely different.
But it's bodies. It's all bodies.
It does inform bodies, yes.
And I love, body movement, and I love the physical body. And I genuinely do. I genuinely find, athletes, and I just find them amazing that, they can spend so much... so much attention to detail of in their performance, because it's not just the body, it's about, you know, in gymnastics and whatever it is, whatever sports or physical activity is, it's about being able to use the body to its maximum, you know, potential.
Yeah, it's amazing.
And so yes, that was my background. So yeah, 2012, I was actually in the position of looking for to get a new job or a new business or a new career, and I was just really looking for businesses, and I had the opportunity to pitch to a business consultant who looks at businesses, whether it's got any, he calls it sticky. Does it stick? Like, will it ground itself?
Right.
You know, if you sort of put a javelin in the something, will it like get into the ground? So I just made that bit up, but I suppose that's what he used to say. He used to say,
will it stick?
Will it stick? Is it, so when it meant a stickiness, does it have stickiness? Does it, will it serve the community? Can the client pay? Is it the biggest thing that I find most attractive? And this is honestly God's truth, is that I used to didn't like problems when I was younger. Or I just don't like problems and the way it was presented. A lot of my friends went into social work or working with people with problems. And I thought, forget that. I don't want to work with anyone's problems. I don't even want my own problems. I just want a nice life. I just want to...
So you go to teaching. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So how did that go for you then?
And I just thought, I completely, obviously, and my illusion was that, yeah, I'll just make, you know, I'll help people become great and they can go off and change the world and be in professions. I never saw it as like teaching as a problem.
Right. Oh, that's great. That's right. Yeah.
It was in my mindset. It was like, and because I did sports science, I said, yeah, they can be really good at sports and they can like go and win gold medals and I could, you know, I just like completely can tell where my mind is. And so coming back to this business mentor, what he said is that, does your service solve a problem?
Mm-hmm. Good question.
And then I thought, my God, I never liked that word. But now why is it coming back to visit me again? And I thought, yeah, it's like death. It's like the biggest problem. It is the most feared problem, what if you want to call it a problem or experience, that we have according to the human race. Yes. So the question was, yes, it does solve that. Did it solve a need? Yes, because people are dying like every minute somebody's dying in the UK. But simultaneously, three babies are born every, so it's 3 to 1. So it's not bad. I always have to say it like that. People say, oh my God, that's so depressing. I said, yeah, but we have 3 babies and I have 6 of them. You know? So it's all cool. And the last one was that, will your client pay? I said, well, yeah, well, they would have to pay because I paid, you know, my sister-in-law died and yeah, it's something that we pay for. And so I basically hit those 3 questions.
Wow.
And it wasn't about anything about the funerals. It was just, did I hit those 3 questions?
Goodness.
So I hit those 3 questions and also I have to say that my husband, Alistair Anderson, who I work with, at the time, he was working for the City of London Cemetery Crematorium.
Ah.
He was, he'd been running the crematorium for the last 3 years. 3 years of those 13 years, he wanted to move up or move across because he was, okay. You know, he plateaued, as you do after 13 years in particular, same old, same old. And there wasn't anywhere for him to go because there was lots of changes. And so he also saw a real gap in the market.
Mm-hmm.
And what he realised is that funerals were becoming industrialised. They were becoming conveyor beltish. Although I don't like that word, but they were becoming, you know, the same, same. And he said that, well, actually, he wants to do a funeral where that we have more time with the family, that mm-hmm. it is much more bespoke, that the person who's passed away, they are reflected, and the funeral is about them as well, mm-hmm. as well as about the family. And if they have a religious background, then it can be you know, those 3 things. So he had this idea, and I said to him, I am going to actually steal your idea or replicate your idea. That's the more favorable word yeah. they use, don't they? So I stole his idea and I pitched, and they loved it. They wanted to invest, and I said no, because I'd also been part of the mentorship program on a business course where they said, the same person said, if you take on investments early on, they will completely eat your business up.
Wow.
So he, and I thought, I'm not going to go against your advice. I said, no, thank you. And I just kept quiet and said, I'm good. So he gave me a couple of like nuggets, said, right, okay, go and do 4 funerals, then go and do the next, and go and do the next. So within 6 months, we'd done, well, I'd done 20 funerals. Wow. Just worked really, really hard. And we had something called a lean model structure at the time, lean business model, where we negotiated and partnered with existing funeral directors and used their premises for a fee, you know, paid them.
Yeah.
And I was very diligent about that, so made sure that all our fees, because I heard that another thing that I didn't like is that these people turning up and opening this and not paying, and I just don't. When it comes to money, I'm very respectful of money.
Mm.
I think, you know, I love money, and with money you can do huge amount of good and great.
You can.
So in that sense, I've always really respected money and the power of money and what it does to you as an energy form.
Yeah.
So that's us really. So where compassionate funerals, the word compassionate comes from, is really this woman called Joan Halifax from America. She's a Buddhist. She's white American. I think she may be a monk, but I'm not sure. And she works in end of life there. They call it actively dying in America.
Okay, nice term.
But it freaked people out here. They said, "What the? What is that?" I said, "Well, actually, we're all actively dying. We just don't know about it."
Well, fair point, I suppose.
But anyway, here in the UK, we call it terminally ill palliative. So, and she did this brilliant talk on TED.
Did she?
Yeah, she's done lots of talks. She's very YouTube rich. So. So she did this talk on compassion and what is compassionate care and why be compassionate, why teach compassion. And I remember that first year in 2013, I was fasting. So it was a bit later on and I'd gone out to a cemetery and done a burial and I'd walked across Wanstead Flats and I was coming back thinking like, I don't know if I could do this anymore. I was like really, I was fasting and it'd been hot and it had been a really difficult funeral, as in the person who passed away was had learning difficulties, the family had learning difficulties, the whole funeral had lots of people learning difficulties, wheelchair, and it was just a really physically and emotionally hard funeral. And I came back and I just lied down and thought, I don't think I could do this anymore. And then I thought, what can I do to get myself out of this state? So I put on Joan Halifax and watched her. And there I thought, this woman is my cornerstone. She's my rock, you know. And so we named our funeral company. I've come from compassion and compassionate. And it goes through so many different, you know, in Islam, it's how you start the Quran with, your prayers with, Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, which means in the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. So, you know, so if we can live, you know, a funeral service in when I mean infused with compassion all the way through the paperwork, you know, and just slowing things down, because I get a lot of things within our team that say, oh, we should do this, and we should. I said, no, let's just calm down. Let's just, you know, what are we about? We're about compassion. We've got to do things compassionately. We've got to live, you know, we've got to literally live it. And when we named ourselves Compassionate Funerals, John Underwood, head of Death Cafe, he came to meet us and he said to us last summer, he said, that's a big thing to follow. And I said, yeah, it is a big thing to follow, because, you know, I don't want to name a funeral service after my name or someone like something and sons. I don't want to do that, because it's not about family. It's about really making a difference to our lives so we can make a difference to other people's lives.
Mm.
And it's using the power of compassion to live that. And and he was saying, you know, good luck. And I said, he didn't mean it sarcastically.
Okay.
He genuinely meant, you know, I wish you well. I wish you well. And hence that's why we, you know, all our branding is with the lotus flower.
Yeah.
And it sounds very Buddhist-esque, but it's not. We're both Muslims. We love Buddhism. Don't you know, get us wrong. I mean, I love some of the Buddhist practices, and but so that's where compassionate funerals came out of.
It is such an important word, incredibly important word, and difficult. Am I projecting here? What I guess from my experience of going through the experience of bereavement is the compassion to oneself when you're going through the bereavement process is probably the most difficult to do. Mm-hmm. So it's much easier, and this is just me speaking from my personal experience, to show compassion and to be compassionate with somebody who is bereaved. But actually to be compassionate with ourselves going through that process can be really difficult. To talk to ourselves in the way that we would talk to other people going through a similar experience can be really tricky. Mm. Because human nature is we tend to be quite judgmental on ourselves and far more compassionate and empathetic with other people.
Absolutely.
And it's getting us, it's, you know, getting to the point where we can do that for ourselves as well, isn't it, through that process and be compassionate as we are going through that bereavement process. And if you're getting that experience from the get-go with the funeral director, that must help. It can only help that person get in touch with the compassion for themselves as well.
Absolutely. I mean, just before you came, we're working with a family at the moment, their mum's funeral on Tuesday, and the client rang up and said, oh, you know, and I can sense he's really having a tough time. So what we say is that if you're having a tough time, go for it. You know, don't shortcut it. Don't, like, you know, like, ignore it or deny it is even worse, because it will only come out somewhere else. Or if it does come out somewhere else, it could come out really in a destructive way. And you're thinking, why is it that I'm feeling so angry or so depressed? Actually, do you know, I'm actually feeling like this because my mum's gone and I don't know how to be like without my mum. And we say, you know, just go for it. And when I started saying this, especially in the hospices a couple of years ago, people were saying, where are you getting this from? I said, I'm getting this because I never actually grieved for my mum. You know, when my mum passed away 20 years ago, and then my mother-in-law died within 3 months, my second daughter was like 2 months, 3 months old, or 2 weeks old when my mum died. I did not physically have any time to, like, say to myself, actually, do you know, life is, like, crap. You know, life is crap, and it's taken me 20 years or like 17, 18 years to say, you know, I didn't get whatever I felt, which is like, you know, why me, why not someone else, there's so many other people, and just to go through all those or whatever feelings that you have, as and they are really hard, awful feelings, because I didn't have a great relationship with my mom, and I wished I could have had, but I can't turn those, but I don't have any regrets, because I feel the mom that chose me as her daughter, she gave me the right lessons to have to be a mum, because I genuinely feel that I have a really brilliant relationship with my kids. We're very, very open, and I love being a mum. That's the thing, you know. Lots of things I love being, but I love being a mum, and I seem to sort of attract lots of kids, you know, who like to hang out with me or our home, do you know what I mean? Because we're very open and accepting. Yeah. My kids might not like that, you know, but, you know, it's like, we say, listen, we have a visitor, everyone's a visitor. You're a visitor, I'm a visitor.
We're all visitors on this planet, exactly. Aren't we? We don't own any of it, but human nature thinks we do.
Yeah.
Are you aware of the Kubler-Ross change curve?
Mm-hmm.
That talks about the stages of bereavement, doesn't it? Of shock, denial, anger, frustration, depression, experimentation, integration. And it's really important, I think, that people are aware that grief and bereavement is a process. And it's okay to experience all of those. It's okay to be angry. It's okay to be sad.
So just, Katie, so it's sort of moved on. That theory has moved on.
Okay.
And so there's quite a new theory that's coming out, theory stroke practice, and observation of clinical studies by George Bono. Anyway, he calls his latest book, it's about 2 years old, it's called The Other Side of Grief. Mm. And he talks about that grief is like a wave.
I love that, and
we use that with our families, and we say, do you know, it sort of hits you, and you could be in the shop, and you think, oh my god, I'm gonna, like, whatever. So that wave hits you, and that wave can be whatever that wave is. It could be denial, it could be loss, it could be guilt, it could be like not enough, it could be I wish I said this, you know, regrets. Yeah. It could be bargaining, I wish I had more time. So we say, when that grief hits you, when the wave of grief hits you, you know, ride it fiercely and ride it deeply, and then go wherever it is that you have to go, then go to that place. If you have to go to nature, I feel that nature is the most beautiful place to go and express or hang out with your grief, because when you genuinely hang out with your grief, it absorbs it. You know, the nature absorbs the energy of the grief that you're feeling. And I'm just saying this from experiencing it myself. You know, we're so fortunate and blessed to live right next to Epping Forest. And when the minute I feel rubbish, I just say, right, I'm here, please look after me. And I just feel whatever I feel. I either walk, run, often I just walk because I just feel I have to get it out. So it's like the grief wave and really learn, you know, just embrace it and see what it is that's making you feel what it's doing. So, yeah, our thing is like, yeah, hit it or, you know, ride with it. Like,
get your surfboard out and ride the wave.
Yeah, go for it.
But people are quite often frightened to do that, aren't they? Of the enormity of that emotion. So they will try and swallow it. I mean, literally swallow their grief. And as you rightly say, it will come back and hit you squarely between the eyes later. But it can be scary as well. That intense emotion can be really scary for people.
Yeah, and some people want to be with their friends, you know, over a cup of tea, you know, and they just want to sob their heart out. I had a friend who lost their father, and she said to me, like, a year after, she said, I wish we'd turned the life support machine off. And I said, why is that? And she was just crying and crying. I said, why is that? And she says, because we stopped him from dying. He was ready to meet his Lord.
Gosh.
So for her, that was the most poignant part. It wasn't any other part, anything else. It was at that point, we extended his suffering, you know. Yeah. And for her, she felt really deeply guilty because it was a decision she made and she was part of it. And she said, we didn't have to do that. And she said, it's actually crucifying my sister that we didn't do that. We made him suffer longer than he needed to. And I just, you know, and I listened to her, and she said, what's your take? And I said, you know what, you made the best decision at that right moment. It's just that now, in hindsight, it's just making you feel shit. Well, sorry, it's not making you feel bad about it. So I would say just really, really, if it's coming up, then be with it, you know, befriend it. That's what I used to say.
Befriend it.
Like you would, you know, befriend. If you can make, for example, friends with your enemies, why can't you befriend your grief? It's only inside you. It's not something. Exactly. It's not another human being. It's not going to like hit you or the government or a local authority or something. Or an organisation, do you know what I mean?
And it is, it's coming back to that word compassion again, is that when we're feeling those intense emotions, which we in our conscious ego state, we put into a box of being good or bad. So we feel kind of guilt, anger, frustration, depression. We kind of put into the bad box, and we are not compassionate with ourselves to recognize it's part of being a human being. It's part of living. We are going to have these emotions, these feelings, and they're not negative. They're not bad. They are part of being human. They're part of being alive.
Mm.
And it is, as you rightly say, embracing them and riding that wave, which is really important.
Mm. Definitely, definitely. Using the other person who's passed away.
Yeah.
Using, you know, the presence, if you will allow yourself to do that, and just sort of bring them up and say, look, I need your help. I can't do this on your own. Please forgive me for all the things I didn't get right, or all the things I got wrong. And, you know, I just want you to help me and love me and help me to get over this, you know. And when my brother died this time last year, I remember because my father was my client. It was like a really,
gosh,
really, like, I mean, talk about test or what. But again, I thought, you know, at the end of the day, if I couldn't do it, I wouldn't have done it. And while I was, again, you know, we had a very fast funeral. But I spent the early morning prayers just being with my grief and just really crying deep from my soul. And all I kept him feeling was just that, do you know what, I'm sorry, but my time's done. And that's all I kept saying. When I saw him at the hospital, he died. And I was looking at him, and it was really surreal. And I could hear him saying, I could feel him saying to me that, I'm sorry, but I'm done. And I'm going, and I've gone. And I'm sorry that I've left you guys like this. And he just really deeply apologized. And his level of asking for, you know, forgiveness stayed with me for such a long time that I don't feel bad about him dying.
Mm.
You know, I don't feel saddened by his loss. I feel sad that I don't have a big brother, but I do have a big brother. He's just not
here.
World. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it felt initially a bit embarrassing because, you know, you run a funeral service and you're having to deal with your own bereavement, with your own family. You think, my God, this is what... And I think at some level, it's a huge gift in the sense that this is how families feel. You know, although I felt it, but since being a funeral director, I've lost my mother-in-law as well early on the year, but she wasn't that close to me. Of course I was upset and I was sad and we'd done the funeral, but it didn't have that, you know, he was my brother for 50 years.
Yeah.
And we travelled the world together as kids. Gosh. And he always had my back. He was like my bodyguard. When my life fell apart, I had my big brother turn to. And he kept saying to me in my prayers, he said, look, I'm still here. You know, I am still here. So you just can't come and visit me.
I mean, you're quite unusual in that, obviously, you're a woman. You're a Muslim woman. Is it unusual to start your own business, and is it unusual to start this kind of business?
Well, there's lots of questions. Yes, it is unusual. There's not that many of us. There's not that many women funeral directors who run their own, who run the show, basically. So yes, it's unusual. And see, I never went down it with that. I never went for the whole feminist thing. I'm going to prove a point. I'm not interested.
No.
That was something of the
80s. I'm just wondering. It's old stuff. But, I'm just wondering if you experienced anything from other people.
Yeah, of course, yeah. Especially from members of my own community, the male members of my own community.
Interesting, okay.
I did. And because they couldn't place me, right. You see. It's like I didn't fit in the box, and I thought, "Well, create another box." But even that, I have to say, my whole thing is that how do I befriend you? How, you know, if I'm going to live compassionately, it's like, how can I help you to break down your own views that you have of me, so I can actually work with you. So. Instead of saying, you know, you git, I don't want to know you, see you later, I'm going to bring you down. You know, that's the thing. When you live a life of compassion, if compassion flipping hits you in the face and saying, you can't be like this. You can't be a bitch, basically.
Or judgmental.
Yeah, or judgmental or difficult. Because at the end of the day, I believe that whoever you meet, they're either your teacher for a reason, for a season, or for a lifetime, you know, whether that's your kids. And so I just think, well, do you know, you're in my life, so I might as well make the best of it. But I did remember when somebody saying to me that, you know, you're actually going to trailblaze. And I was thinking, what's that? I thought trailblazing was something to do with, adventure activities. I genuinely thought this would be mountaineering. I love mountains and love mountaineering and being in the outdoors. And then they went, well, trailblazing is that you're changing the paradigm. I was going, well, I'm not interested. I'm genuinely not interested in that whole feminist stuff. I'm genuinely not. I just want to help people, and that's all I want to do. And I want to know that I'm making a difference rather than pushing a whole load of paper. That's why I left education and making everything so, paper-based. I don't want to do that. I just want to help people, and that's all. And I want to, you know, make people feel better. And I had, like, really simple offerings. And I just thought, well, you know, let the whole women thing be. But I have to say, I haven't actually experienced that huge amount of discrimination or sexism. I think people are intrigued, like what you said. I'm a bit unusual and a bit different. Then I've just used that to my advantage.
Great.
You know, I think, you know, if you're unusual, then break down that very quickly and get to connect with people and find some common. A lot of people I meet, I've been to school with. It's just amazing. A lot of people I meet in the industry, I've been to school. They're a year younger than me. They're in the next school, in the next street. Like, so it's cool if you come round from Stepney. It's true. If you come to Stepney, you're doing well, because you'll be meeting me at some point in your lifetime. It's so funny. I have so many, like, people.
But you went into it with the right attitude, though. It was coming from your passion, from your heart.
Yeah.
You wanted to make a difference. You wanted to create end of life experience for the person dying and for the people left behind that was compassionate. And actually all the political stuff had absolutely no interest. So you're coming from your heart. And when you come from your heart, I think anybody, when they are coming from their heart, from their true life purpose, and they're making a difference, not to make a point, but to make a difference. And there's a huge difference between those two statements. then people are going to be attracted to you. You are this lighthouse, this beacon that people, you are the safe haven that people will change direction and come into your safe harbour because that's what you're creating. And people will always know when somebody is operating from a heart space and not from a head space. We are, every human being is attracted to that heart space because we feel it on a deep soul cellular level. It's that integrity, it's that, that humanistic approach. You do cross faith funerals,
and
don't
non-faith.
You? And non-faith. We were having a discussion before, which I was fascinating. We've got 5 minutes, marvellous, of the kind of humanistic funeral. And you were saying a lovely, lovely story about a professional funeral when the family was struggling to know what kind of funeral to do for somebody. Can you tell us a bit more about that?
Yeah,
kind
of... so we just recently, on 2 days ago, we had this huge funeral from our neighbourhood of a lady who passed away in her early 50s from liver cancer. And she's got 2 young children. I know her husband. I've known her husband for a long time. And he's like one of the mums around him, actually. So, and when they were telling the story, they just said, what do we say? What do we say? Cause, and I was listening. And the more I listen, I said, look, I think you have to give this person a double funeral, like not double time or 2 different ones, but all in one. That she was, you know, this person, she was your wife, she was a mother, but really what she was is that she was this huge contributor to society. She was a head teacher. And she touched so many lives, and music was a big part of her world and your world. Very big music family, and even the person who led the funeral was a head teacher from a school in Cambridge. Because normally we have you know, professionals who lead the funeral service, like a priest or a celebrant, humanist celebrant. But in this case, it was really fitting that we got somebody. I mean, when you have teachers or lawyers or anyone who works in public speaking profession. In a way, you don't need anyone public because you can lead the whole funeral yourself if you're, you know, if you're strong enough on the day. So so he was asked to lead the funeral, and the funeral was totally based on her contribution that she made during her lifetime on this earth, especially in the last 40 years. She'd been 30 years she'd been working in East London. She's from Wales. And she worked in Newham and worked in primary education. And she was all about seeing the qualities in somebody and moving them on forward, moving them on, rather than just keeping them and keeping them. And I loved that. And I, after the funeral, I went up to the person who led the funeral and I said, so were you good friends with her? He went, no, not at all, not when I was working for her. But the minute I moved on, we became best friends.
Wow.
Because she saw my potential. And that's what her gift was. Is that she was a brilliant at management. She was one of these. And when I was listening to the funeral, it did remind me, and I don't want to come as arrogant, that I don't like doing things, takes things ages and ages. I think if you can do things, you know, really fast, really powerful, a lot of energy, a lot of concentration, get them done. Why spend 2 weeks when you can do it in 2 weeks? You can. You can actually work really hard and fast and smart. And so she had so many qualities, and so the school came, the school attended, children attended from the school, children from the local community attended. It was such an amazingly powerful funeral that even afterwards, at the funeral reception, people were saying that in funny ways we actually enjoyed that, and we got to know about who she was because we didn't know who she was.
Yeah.
And then that's what the funeral is really to celebrate her successes.
That's what they should all be about, isn't it? It's about celebrating somebody's life and how they touched people and everybody who attends the funeral of somebody, even if they only met them once, we touch somebody in some way, don't we? And it is about celebrating that existence rather than grieving. Obviously we have to grieve, but it is about a celebration. Do you notice a difference very quickly in the different faiths of how we approach death, or is there a common theme?
There is a common theme, and some people just want to experience the mourning experience, and some people want to experience the celebration experience, and some people want to do a combination of both.
Right.
But I suppose what I would say, one of my, again, you know, I'd love to end on a high, but is that coming back to bereavement, which we started with, is that really what happens to people afterwards? And that's one of my biggest concerns. And I spend my, you know, I end my day thinking, how can I make a difference to bereaved people? How can we make their journey easier, their life lighter, so they can go back to their life's purpose? Mm. And I would say that's probably still a lot of work to be done there.
There is. Mm-hmm. Well, you are a trailblazer, whether you want to be or not. So accept it with the grace that you have oozing out of every pore of your being. And know that you are absolutely making a difference.
Yeah. Well,
so thank you, Hasina. So. It's been a wonderful interview. Thank you.
Thank you. Brilliant.
This has been Katie Day, and you've been listening to Creating Ripples. Listen in and be part of the revolution that is rocking the world. Women everywhere are the new future. We are awesome, fearless, fabulous, inspiring, passionate, courageous. In fact, we just rock.